This is the Plant on the Line program here at thecommentary.ca. Roy McGregor has written a column in the Globe and Mail since 2002. Before that, he was at the National Post, the Ottawa Citizen, Maclean's, and the Toronto Star. He has won 4 National Magazine Awards and received 8 National Newspaper Award nominations. In 2005, he was appointed an officer of the Order of Canada. He is described in his citation as one of Canada's most gifted storytellers, and that he is in his newest book, Canadians, A Portrait of a Country and Its People, an engaging and highly readable journey across the country, its identity, and the people in this land. The book is $35 and published by Viking. Roy McGregor joined me from here in Vancouver.
Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Roy McGregor. Good morning, Mr. McGregor.
Hi, Joseph. How are you?
Very well, thank you. This is a remarkable book and an enjoyable one. Did you enjoy writing it?
Sometimes. I enjoyed the idea of it, to try to come up with a book that would encompass this rather vast and impossible country. And I loved doing some of the chapters, and it, the Native Affairs bit, hockey, dealing with the Trudeau train, taking the body of Pierre Trudeau back to Montreal, all that kind of stuff. And then I found some of it difficult, like foreign affairs or Quebec's difficult, whether you're writing about it, talking about it, or doing it, let's face it.
As a journalist, Barry, you mentioned you were on the Trudeau train, you were at covering Meech Lake with Elijah Harper, you were at Oka.
Yes.
Do you think you understand the country better because you were there when history was unfolding, if you will?
Well, yes, I'll pretend that I do, but more honestly, I would say that the more you delve into the country, the more complicated it becomes, and there's a beauty to that, that it's not simplistic. And to the idea that you could say, well, this is the typical Canadian, is as far-fetched as you can imagine. There is no typical Canadian. You are a Canadian. I am a Canadian. People that I can see from where I'm sitting walking down the street are all Canadians. And we're all the definition of Canada in our own way, I think.
Do you think you gain more having traveled the land? People like me who don't get out much, if you will. You've seen the vast expanse of the country. Do you think you understand it perhaps better than I would?
I don't know. I do know that I've spent 30 or 35 years now traveling the country almost constantly. Not constantly, but let's say a week of every single month. And so I would not be shy about saying that I am one of a half dozen people probably who've seen more of the country than anyone else. And maybe in my case I've seen the most of the country as a lone wolf because I always travel by myself. So let's think about the size of this country. I've often said to people, yeah, I've traveled everywhere, but in fact, what have I seen? 1% of the country? 2% of the country? Let's be very generous and go to 5% of the country, which I don't happen to believe I have seen. So you're talking to somebody who's seen less than 5% of the country, who's maintaining he's the expert on the country and that. That's a story in itself. You can't know it. And it's only in going into the far north that the sheer vastness of this country starts to resonate with you.
Now, people have been writing books like yours in the past, and I think of Bruce Hutchinson,
yes.
The Unknown Country, Walter Stewart. You write about both in your book as well as others. Their Canada is far different than yours, do you
yes.
think? Or it is. Now, do you think it's changed for better or worse? If you can...
Well, I wasn't there in 1942 when Bruce Hutchinson wrote The Unknown Country, but what I did in selling this book was say, I think his title stands up pretty well, The Unknown Country, so let's have another look at it. Now, he was looking at a country that he thought was kind of like a teenage boy, a young buck about to set out in the world and make its mark. And at the end of his life, he was very, very disappointed. I went and saw him in Victoria in 1991. He was then about 90 years of age, and he was so upset about the Meech Lake Accord. He was absolutely despondent. You know, here's a guy who had been called the eternal optimist by people like Pierre Burton and Peter Newman. Well, the eternal optimist was suddenly a terrible pessimist about the country. I remember being out in his garden. It was raining in Victoria. The rain was coming down. He was standing there in his cane. And I had mentioned to him that, you know, he had written The Unknown Country, and then he had written The Unfinished Country, and he suddenly rattled the cane in the air, and he said, there won't be a third. And then he made two predictions. One was, he said, I don't think I'll last another year. And two was, I don't think the country's got another 2 years in it. Well, he was right about himself. He was dead by the end of the year. And He was dead wrong about the country. Country kind of, it just moseys on. It's the bumblebee nation, I call it. It defies all logic, but it flies.
Are we, as Canadians, insecure, do you think? I mean, you talked about foreign, you wrote the chapter on foreign affairs was hard for you to write. Are we insecure, do you think, when we compare ourselves to, if we compare ourselves to Americans and other countries?
Well, I spent a lot of time in the book talking about the contradictions of Canada. How almost every time you point out one thing, you could point out the opposite. And so I think there's an insecurity there, but I also think there's a superiority there, and sometimes it comes across as smugness. And it's quite irritating at times to Americans in particular, because they get the feeling that Canadians in their self-righteous moments are kind of staring down their nose at what they do and what they say. So in terms of foreign affairs, I've argued, I don't know whether successfully or not, but I say there is a role for Canada to play. We can't help where we live. We can't help who we are. But we can't just constantly define ourselves as non-Americans, as it seems that we often do, and certainly the rest of the world does. We're non-Americans. No, we are who we are, and we can be the Jiminy Crickets of the world. We can be sitting on the shoulder of that giant, and we can both be insecure about what's happening, and I think a little secure and maybe even superior about the way we view it, and maybe sometimes we have to be that annoying voice saying, maybe there's another way, or maybe you want to rethink this, just as Jiminy Cricket did to Pinocchio. That's our role, as I see it.
You know, you talked about being different from Americans. I'm thinking of the Spicer Commission,
yes,
which you write about in the book. You played a role, sort of. I suppose you were the 13th commissioner.
Accidentally.
Americans would not have something like that, some royal commission on, or in this case, a commission on
dead
who
on.
They are.
Joseph, you're dead on. English don't spend any time really puzzling over what's an Englishman. The French don't spend time puzzling over what's a French person. And Americans certainly don't spend time, as we do, endlessly picking through the belly button lint of the nation to try to find out what we are. We've turned it into a cottage industry, this puzzlement over who we are, the Canadian identity. I'm not so sure that it's as vague as some would say. The great literary critic Northrop Frye, he's always quoted as saying that, you know, the essence of Canadian literature, the essence of Canada is the ultimate question, where is here? Well, I'm sorry, Professor Frye. I think you're dead wrong. I think people who live in this country are absolutely certain of where here is. Here is where I am. I am Canadian. I happen to be standing in Victoria. I happen to be standing in the Lower Mainland. I happen to be standing in northern BC, northern Ontario, northern Quebec, Newfoundland, Toronto, if I may throw that in. Wherever they are, they kind of do know who they are. And so that I think that the Canadian identity has emerged considerably, partly through our endless navel gazing, but partly because we're 140 years old. Let's get over this whole thing about the sky is falling, the world's coming to an end, the country can't possibly last. There's a word out there called, quote, nation, that's going to destroy us all like some, you know, sticks and stones can't do the damage a little name-calling can. Doesn't happen. We muddle on. We do okay.
It seems to me that if they had some sort of commission like Spicer today, what we found out then would be a lot different. What we would hear from Canadians would be a lot different. Talk to me about covering that commission at that time. This was right after the Meech Lake Accord failure, correct?
Yeah. Well, I guess that's the most angry I've ever been as a journalist. I just was so deeply offended by 11 men in suits deciding what was best for the country, delivering something that they had decided was right for the country, telling the country that there was no, quote, egregious error in what they had compiled. You know, what a stupid elitist word to use, for example. Egregious. I had to go look it up. It means there's no no wrong in it. And then to act like we can't even discuss the matter, we simply have to approve of it without any consultation of the people who actually live in this country. So Meech Lake was a turning point for me. I just was so offended, having covered Parliament Hill for 14 years. I wanted nothing more to do with it. I wanted out there. To me, it wasn't a case of sending out messages, which was what Ottawa had become. It was a case of sending back messages. So I wanted to get out into the country and talk to people about how they saw their country. The Spicer Commission kind of brought that out. People were articulate. People were interesting. The national media was laughing at them. And this really started to eat away at me. And I kept thinking, okay, they're living in Ottawa, the attitude is ridicule. Well, I'm not going to buy into that. I think these are real people who've done some real thinking, and I'm going to take them seriously. So my life changed that way, following the Spicer Commission, because I realized how engaged people were in the country, how much in love with the country they were, and how much they were as equally offended as I was by this performance out of Ottawa. It's not about the content of the Beach Lake Accord. It's not about any of the five demands of Quebec or anything. It was the way it was handled, you know, the roll of the dice, and then let's go from there. So things would be quite different now. For one thing, people don't want to talk about that. They don't want to get into the Constitution thing. We've been there, we've done that. It made us sick to our stomachs, and we're not ready for it for a long time. Then the other thing I think it came out of a poll that the Globe and Mail, of all places, that's where I work, did a poll about 3 years ago. We were trying to come to some understanding about the new Canadians. So, you know, Canada has so dramatically changed in the last decade, certainly dramatically changed in the last 50, 60 years since the Depression. We're now 80% urban, 20% rural. We used to be 20% urban, 80% rural, complete flip-flop. But what we were doing is talking about new Canadians, multiculturalism, immigration. It always comes to the main cities, certainly in Vancouver, one of the five main areas that they come to. So we asked in this survey, what is it about this country that speaks to you the most? What is it about the country that defines Canada? So we were anticipating that they would come up and talk about Medicare, of course, or maybe hockey, or
right,
something like that, or one of the touchstones, like the Rocky Mountains, or Peggy's Cove, or the Peace Tower. We didn't know. 90% of them said, what speaks to us most about the country is the sheer vastness of the land. So these people, whether they come to cities to live 3 months ago or 30 years ago, they're still very aware of how magnificent and vast this land is, and they're very much in love with it. So I think the landscape is what people would talk about now, not the Constitution, and I think that has had a profound effect, and it has shown the change that has happened since what you were talking about, the Spicer Commission years.
You saw that as well at the Charlottetown Accord, the rejection of that.
Yes, and you know, the original Meech Lake Accord had nothing for Aboriginals in it. The Charlottetown Accord did. And I think that there was some good stuff in the Charlottetown Accord. It's just that the people were so offended at this point by the kind of we know what's best for you that Charlottetown didn't have much of a chance.
You said that the country changed dramatically in the last 10, 15 years since that time. Where do you see the country in the next 10, 15 years?
I see it surviving, and I think sometimes I'm unique in that because we're a country of, well, we're the northern personality, you know. It's affected by light deprivation and bad weather. We tend to be kind of Calvinist about everything. Everything's going to go to hell in a handbasket. We seize on that so quickly. After 140 years of the country working pretty well, I think it's going to continue to work pretty well. We are an imperfect model to the world, but we are a model to the world when it comes to tolerance, integration, and people working together. Let's not kid ourselves, there's all sorts of problems, but other countries like France, Holland, they're showing far more serious problems, far more serious problems. We're working it out. It's the Canadian way. You go back to 1759, you have the British taking on the French, and the British triumph. We're not even supposed to call it the conquest anymore, but because of the outcome of the 7 Years' War in 1763, and you have Britain taking over what was then New France, the numbers were so bad, there were very few Brits and all kinds of French, that the Brits had to compromise. So they had to say, okay, you're going to have your own laws, you're going to have your own civil code, you're going to have your own way of life, and certainly your own language. And I think that's where it all began. Canadians are deal makers, whether it's internationally or within the borders of Canada. We make a deal, we compromise, because we know that's the only way to get along, and you can see that everywhere, from the settlement of the West, where settlers had to help each other, from the development of Medicare, where people had to say, okay, we're in this together. And that's what makes us different from the Americans. And that, I think, is also what means, that, to me, that Canadians are going to survive and thrive over the next 15 years.
There's some wonderful sketches in this book of your travels throughout the world, throughout the country. I want to ask you about how patriotic Canadians are, and you illustrate that with an anecdote. You were covering the Olympics, and you noticed that when they were playing O Canada, all of you cynical journalists. What did you do?
Well, as you well know, patriotism only flares. It always burns in the United States, but it only flares here, and you have to have an Olympic gold medal or July 1st or something like that has to happen. Anyway, we were in Turin. All kinds of us were assigned to cover the men's gold medal game, with the presumption being that Canada would be in that game. Of course, they were going to be defending the gold, but it didn't happen. They came seventh, I think. The women, on the other hand, won the gold. But anyway, the very last day of the Olympics, Sunday afternoon, the men were to play for the gold. We had already been assigned to do the game. We had our tickets and everything. We had to go. We did Finland versus Sweden. Sweden wins. We wrote up our little short stories, and then we had nothing to do. The closing ceremonies were a little further away. We couldn't make them. They were also already starting. We couldn't make them in time. So off we went to this restaurant in this little village outside of Turin. We went into the restaurant, and in the back they had a tent area all tented up, kind of, I guess they expanded for the Olympics. There must have been 300 Italians in there having a meal. And on one wall they had a giant television screen with the Turin-Milan soccer game on, sound turned down, and on the other wall a giant television screen with the closing ceremonies on it. And the place was just, you know, it was just a cacophony of sound, because Italians like to talk and eat and visit. They take a long time, and they're very sociable. And some of the men were watching the soccer game, and some of the young boys, I guess, were too. And some few people, like the Canadians, were watching the closing ceremony. And then suddenly there was the handing over the flag, Turin to Vancouver, the 2006 games to the 2010 Winter Olympic Games. And then Ben Hepner, the tenor, came out, the Canadian tenor, and he came out and sang "Old Canada." He sang it beautifully. The place went quite quiet at that point. And then far across the tent, at another table, there were Francophone journalists who were there with us from Quebec. And Bert Raymond, I remember, stood to attention. Very powerful moment. He stood up and he stood very strongly at attention, shoulders back. And one of his cohorts from Quebec stood up with him. And he glared at me as strongly as I've ever been stared at in my life. And I got awkwardly, very Anglophone-y to my feet. And I stood at attention, and then the man beside me stood at attention. A couple of other Canadians stood at attention. So you had about 7 or 8 Canadians at attention during the singing of "O Canada." Ben Hepner gets to the end of the song. It's over, silent, and then the place burst into applause. They all cheered for Canada. They cheered for us. I don't know. I never felt more Canadian in all my life, and that's why I say in the book, we're such a strange people. Canadians are most comfortable in their own skin when their own skin is in another country.
Absolutely, yeah. You open with the Trudeau funeral and the outpouring that happened thereafter in 2000, I guess 7 years ago now. But the one sketch that I found particularly moving was your description of covering Maurice Richard's funeral.
Yes.
And that was the same year, was it not?
Yes.
You,
it was a very strange year, the year 2000.
Now, you were covering hockey, were you not?
I was down covering the Stanley Cup playoffs, and the game was in New Jersey. I think they were playing Dallas, but suddenly word came that Rocket had died. And so word also came, you know, a bunch of people should get to Montreal as quickly as possible. He was lying in state, they announced. He'd be lying in state at what was then called the Molson Center. So I caught an early flight out of New Jersey up to Montreal, and I got in the evening, and I knew that he was going to lie in state until 10 p.m. I got a cab downtown as fast as I could, threw my stuff into the hotel, just checked it with the guys at the desk, and ran all the way to the Molson Center. Got there about 5 after 10. It's already been closed up. People were milling around. Those who had been there were leaving. It was over, and the guards were closing the doors. So I thought, well, I'll interview some of the people that had been in there and see if I can get a story out of it. And I started talking to some people, and then I saw two other people coming. It turned out that it was a man and his son from Saginaw, which is quite a long, long distance away. They've been driving for hours. This is a real separatist part of the country. The Bleuettes, they call, you know, after the blueberries.
Right.
And they're very strongly political. And the older man seemed very agitated. He got to the door and pounded on it. They wouldn't let him in. And he was near tears, and I went over. My French isn't very good, but their English was non-existent. And I found out that they had driven all this way. They'd raced, broken the speed limit. He just wanted to say goodbye to his great hero, Rocket. So I followed these men around, and we went to door after door, and it wouldn't have it. I thought, here's my call-up, but they can't get in. Last door that they pounded on, an older guard looked over, and he came over, and he opened the door. He listened to their explanation, the whole story, and then the older guard just kind of looked down at his downcast eyes, and he nodded once, and he opened the door wider. And I thought, well, he's letting the two of them in, isn't that nice? And then he kept it open, and I realized, I haven't said a word, so he must think I'm one of the another son. So I went in with them, took us down through a curtain into the darkened bowels of the arena. A single spotlight shining down in a casket sitting right at center ice, the Rockets lying in state there. It's a totally open casket. You can see everything from his shoes right to the top of his head. He's wearing a dark suit and a red tie, and the man I'm with starts walking over to him, and I'm walking beside him, and all I can hear him say is, merci, Maurice, merci, merci, merci. He's thanking him, and he starts crossing himself as he gets near there, and he goes and he stands beside Rocket, and he stands there, and he prays, and his son prays, and then the older man starts to weep, and he keeps saying, merci, 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 Maurice. And I thought, oh my God, I'm witness to one of the most powerful moments of my career. And not only that, but by sheer accident, I'm going to be the last person to go by Rocket Richard as he lies in state. Then it happened, you know, we moved on. And I looked back, and then I realized I would not be the last. And it was the most moving sight you could imagine. The older guard I spoke to you about had organized all the guards. I don't even want to call them guards. They're ushers, but they looked like guards. They were in uniform. The ushers, he'd organized the ushers, and he had them marching in military formation. It wasn't perfect or anything. They marched from where the Zamboni chute was to center ice, and then they stood there, and then the older usher saluted the Rocket. And my God, your heart would just break.
And your heart breaks reading that story in your book.
Yeah, it's powerful.
You talked about speaking French. Do you think it's critical people speak French in this country today?
No, you don't have to. You can get by perfectly well without it. Is it important that people make the effort? I happen to think it is. But I live in Ottawa, and I see what's happened to my children. One became bilingual, and she has all sorts of opportunities, and the others did not choose to go into French immersion, and they're having all kinds of troubles. And my son has said to me numerous times in the last several months as he hunts for a job, boy, I kick myself. Why didn't I work a little harder at it? I could have a good job now. Not the same, obviously, in other parts of the country. But we are a country where we talk about two founding nations. I prefer to talk about three founding nations because I hate to see the Aboriginals left out in that conversation. But anytime you can try to make an effort to learn that language or in reverse learn the English language, how is that a bad thing?
The last story that you tell in the book is of... This was in the north, I believe. Former Governor General Adrian Clarkson, they were still in office at the time.
Right.
They were putting some sort of time capsule together, correct?
Yep.
You were there?
Yes, I was in. It was in Alert, which is the farthest inhabited place on the farthest north inhabited place on the planet Earth, and it's the Canadian Forces Base. She wanted to make a statement, Adrian Clarkson, just before she left office, about Canadian sovereignty, because the ice is melting up there. Whether people want to deny it or not, that's their business. I've been up there. I've seen it. And you're going to have ships passing through, and the old Northwest Passage is going to be a serious issue in the future. She wanted to make this point, and she went up there, and one of the things she was going to do was build a cairn. And so they went right to the end of the runway at Alert, close to you, stand there and stare off, and presumably you can see Russia. If you can see over the turn of the earth, you'd see Russia.
Right.
And they built a stone cairn about 6 feet tall, and then inside the cairn they were going to put an empty ammunition container with her flag, with the Canadian flag, with a note from her and her husband, and with a few other things people were putting in, little mementos and that.
The last thing that they put in that cairn was...
Sorry, it was Master Warrant Officer Julie Verner, 44-year-old woman from Plunder Bay, kind of the center of, or Sault Ste. Marie, sorry, the center of the country. Father a Francophone, mother an Anglophone, married to a German who had come here of German heritage, and she walks up and she reaches over and she rips the flag off of her arm, the little Velcro flag that's on the soldier's arm, and she puts it inside. And How do you look at that? Do you say, is that desecration of the uniform, or is that serving her country? And I thought, there's the contradiction of Canada right there. I happen to take it as serving your country. And it struck me that here's Canada. It makes perfect sense some days, no sense the other days, but in this day it made absolutely perfect sense. And here's this woman, this 44-year-old woman, a mother, and she's crying as she walks away. That's how important this country is to some people.
And reading this book, you understand just how important it is. Roy, thanks for joining us, and congratulations on a great book, as I said.
Oh, thank you, Joseph. It's been a pleasure talking to you.